So, does everybody have a handout for today? If not, Aaron's got handouts. Also, you'll probably need your handout. You will need your handout from Thursday. And hopefully, the lecture will be a little bit less painful for you all to get through and for me to get through than it was on Thursday. So the point of today's lecture is to try to get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of plant biotechnology. And it's such an odd audience to try to present this to, because for some of you, I know that you know all the details of the plant background, and some of you know none of the details. So I'm trying to present more of an overview of what the biotechnology process is. We'll start out talking a little bit about product development, although not in great detail, because this didn't seem like there was a whole lot of content that I could put there, but I did try to give you some numbers to give you a little bit of a feel for how much plant biotechnology is going on and what impact it has on our life these days. And then how one actually does gene transfer. We've decided on a product, or in the case of your homework, you have an assignment to come up with a product. How do you get that gene into plants, if that's your choice of how to do that particular homework assignment? And then I'll talk about different ways in which one can get genes into plants to make a stable transformation. And then finally, at the end of the lecture today, I should have some time to talk about some of the very earliest commercial products that were made from plant biotechnology. There were some tomato fruit ripening projects, and what happened to the first one and what happened to the second one. What was the biology behind it, so that you get some idea of what they were doing at the time. So if you actually probably will need to start with your handout from Thursday, and about, after the phytoremediation part, there's a page that looks kind of like this. And again, if you can't see what I'm putting on the overhead, make sure you know, because I know the screen up here is a little bit different than the screen that I have. Basically, there's two strategies when they're developing products, and you're going to tell very quickly where my bias is, and I don't know if that's just because that's what I'm most familiar with, or if that's truly what most of plant biotechnology is doing, but there's sort of two different strategies here on the two different pathways. The one on the left, they call sort of a more traditional breeding pathway, mutagenesis and plant breeding, and you can see molecular breeding, traditional breeding, coming from some mutant isolation or some analytical biochemistry. This is as opposed to the more, modern or more technical plant molecular biology or the biotechnology pathway. Now the difference is, in the whole point, you've got some kind of a trait. We're trying to develop a trait. We're maybe making something that's more herbicide resistant or pesticide resistant, or we're making tomato fruit that are ripe sooner or ripe later, or have some particular trait. And one way one could do it is to identify basically a mutation or some trait that you want to improve upon or exploit in some way. And traditionally they've done that by molecular breeding, breeding it back into maybe a more hybrid crop or improving vigor. And the more modern way would be to say, okay, I know what the pathway is involved, I know the gene that I'm interested in, I'm going to engineer it using modern molecular biology and cell culture, and actually make transgenic plants then that will yield the product that we're looking for. So the difference, the main difference in the two pathways is the one on the right, the molecular biology one. You have to know what the pathway is, the physiological pathway that you're dealing with, the gene that you're interested in. The pathway on the left, you don't. You need to have a phenotype. You need to know what something looks like rather than having the full molecular background for this information. You can also see that this, I just included this from down here. This is from an article in Trends in Biotechnology. If any of you guys really get into it, it's probably a journal that covers all different types of biotech. Well, it is a journal that covers all different types of biotechnology. This was an article from, actually now it's 5 years old, but just to sort of show you how long the development of a product might take from start to finish. And you can see, let's say we have a gene that we're very interested in. On Thursday, we're going to talk a little bit about the development of vitamin E-rich plants. And they're just beyond this stage right now, and it's getting lots of attention. This is where we do the filing of the patents, and we're talking about this is what we, where we think we've got this product or potential product, and so we file a lot of patents. It takes 1 to 2 years. Making the actual transgenic plants can take a couple of years before we even get into the development of the particular variety that's of interest. Regulatory approval can take quite a while, depending on the group that we're working with. I'll talk a little bit later about who you have to get approval from. Testing of the yield, because as you'll see, sometimes putting in a new gene will decrease the yield of the plants, and that may be very bad, in which case you might have to go back here to development and mutant discovery and doing some traditional breeding to improve yields. And then, of course, testing applications, and we'll talk about things that you have to worry about when you're actually testing your products. And, for instance, if we decided we started out here with this really cool gene, we're trying to improve the protein content in a particular plant, but we choose a bad protein, and we find out, what are we now at about 5 to 7 years down the line, that this happens to be a protein that 50% of the human population is allergic to, then that's a bad choice, and you have to go way back at the very beginning. But even if you don't know that it's an allergen, it's something that has to be tested for. So there's a lot of application testing and product testing that goes on here before one goes into bulking up the seed, because obviously with plants you have to grow the whole crop and produce the grain or process the grain or the fruit or whatever product it is that you're looking for. This whole process can take, I think, from beginning to end. You can see it takes something like 8 to 12 years from this initial great idea. So if you're writing a grant proposal today to do some really amazing product, then chances are it will be done long after you get your PhD and by somebody else in the lab or somebody else that would be in the research project at that time. The money that's involved in this, though, is really pretty amazing. Some of the numbers that I'm going to show you are older numbers, and some of them I've tried to update a little bit. The non-food products. So you have to think about this pretty broadly, and it does get a little bit confusing. So there's lots of non-food products, and we'll talk about some of them here, that come from genetically transformed or genetically engineered plants. The amount of money in 1995, which now I realize is quite a while ago, was about $15 million a year. $15 million per year. Now that was predicted to grow in 10 years, so in another 5 years they're predicting it to be at greater than $320 million. So there's really quite a bit. This is in the non-food products. One of the reasons this, that we want to exploit some of these transgenic plants is the fact there's a lot of advantages we'll talk about, but it may help us decrease our reliance on oil-derived chemicals. So lots of chemicals that are additives in foods or additives to plants, pesticides, herbicides, things like that, are oil-derived chemicals, and that's not an environmentally good thing. It would help us redirect U.S. agriculture away from the production of surplus foods. If any of you come from rural backgrounds, you'll realize that there's been a lot of surplus food production, even in U.S. agriculture, and so that, for instance, corn, and that can be a problem because the government then spends a large amount of money on agriculture subsidies to pay the farmers for growing foods that we don't even need, and by using engineered plants, this we can reduce some of these. And in fact, some of these subsidies themselves have ranged between about $6 and $26 million a year, just in subsidies that for growing food that is a surplus. So we can change that just by changing a little bit the types of crops that are being grown. Agroceuticals is this new term, maybe not so new anymore. This new merging of agriculture biotech companies, traditional agriculture companies, and pharmaceuticals. So mergings between like Ciba Geigy and Sandoz to make Novartis. Novartis is a huge agriceutical company now, and they're building a lot of plant biotech industry. There's a huge group down in North Carolina. There's another group out in San Diego now, where they're hiring a tremendous number of scientists. This merger between to make Novartis was more than $100 billion merger. It's really big money. Monsanto, DuPont, they're always fighting and buying. DuPont just merged with Pioneer Hybrid, for instance. Hoechst just bought Plant Genetic Systems. That was another $600 million merger. There's just a lot of money. If we go, this was the non-food. If we go into more of a little different idea, conventional medications, I guess, would be a good thing. Everything from aspirin to some of the most toxic cancer medications. Nearly a fourth of those have at least one active ingredient coming from plants. And in fact, something like the World Health Organization estimates that 80% of the world population presently uses some kind of an herbal product for some part of healthcare. And the vast majority of you probably do. You use hand lotion that has an herbal product in it, or you take some of these cold remedies, or echinacea, or St. John's wort. The numbers now are tremendously high. That Americans alone are expected to spend about, this is just in America, about $6 billion on some of these herbal remedies this year. So it's a good time to get into some of this. This is just in the U.S. But this is actually worldwide, so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the extent, the distribution of biotech around the world. That's the next page in here, this little handout that I gave you, because I knew you all wanted to know all of these exact numbers, but it's mostly because I think that some of these numbers are kind of interesting. This is showing, just to give you some idea, of how many different crops have been exploited. All of these different transgenic crops. I mean, most of you aren't plant biologists, so you would never think that they would have made a transgenic service berry, I bet, in your wildest dreams. Or transgenic walnut. Now, to be perfectly honest, I haven't the foggiest what the transgenic walnut project is. I don't know. My guess is that they're trying to do insecticide resistance or insect resistance with a walnut. It's not too surprising they'd go after something like petunia. Oilseed rape might surprise you. That's actually a canola. So canola oil, 181 different field releases, so different projects of this. Kiwi, I don't have any idea what Gerbera is. There's only been two of those. But you can see, actually, there's been very fairly large numbers. Corn, potato. Potatoes was one of the earlier crops that was easily transformed. And so that was one that there's been a lot of work done with. Soybean, 50% of the soybean and corn crop grown in the world right now is genetically modified in some way. And that would include most of the products then that come from soybean and corn at this time. Over 1,000 field tests, field releases, that's of about 93. Obviously, it's probably doubled at least since then. Let me see what else I want to say about that. The very first trials were with tobacco. You can see there's been over 100 with tobacco. The first trials were with tobacco in 1986. And that was only, 14 years ago. So if you think about that timeline that I gave you, a 7 to 12 year, 8 to 12 years from idea to commercialization, we're just beginning to realize some of the earliest commercial products. So we're way, way still in the log phase on this. If you look at the way where this is done in different countries, it's done all over the world in many countries you might not even think about. Zimbabwe has a single field trial. Obviously, we've got a huge number in the U.S., but there's triple digits in France. In Canada has a large number. Great Britain is fairly active. They've got about 50. The Netherlands, it's really quite a worldwide technology at this point. The regulations of these field releases tends to focus on human safety. They also look at potential risks to the environment. So the factors that they usually consider, oh, the other thing I wanted to just mention was the regulatory commissions at this point. All of these field testing have to satisfy various regulatory limits or commissions. The USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, is what controls most of these field trials. But especially those that are going to focus, and USDA will especially focus on human safety and the environment. The FDA, Food and Drug Administration, is going to control any of these food trials that affect food products. And the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is going to do anything with pesticides or herbicides. So each field trial, as a project nears field trial, they're going to have to satisfy often more than one of these regulatory commissions. This is just in this country. It's very different, and in reading some of the articles, the background for this, it's very different in every country, and in fact, that's why some of these countries that you might not think would have so many have a large number. They tend to have, some of these countries have much lower regulatory limits, and so they're more likely to be sites for early field testing. But one project may have to satisfy regulatory limits both in the USDA and the FDA, because a food product is often going to be of interest for human safety. Pesticides and herbicides are often also going to be of interest for human safety and are certainly going to be assessed for environmental impact. And so they often have to fit more than, or satisfy more than one of these agencies. Okay. So I want to make a list of the factors that they consider. Some of these may or may not be of some use when you're doing your homework assignment, but they are things that the scientists, depending on the actual project, that is considered. So none of these will be of any surprise to you, but if you were told to list them, it would probably be a little bit hard on your own. The first, of course, is you have to figure out, or what has to be considered, is the function of the particular gene of interest in the host or the original donor organism. What does the gene do in its normal, endogenous, everyday location? And then, what would be the effect of taking this and putting it into another plant? So the effect of the transgene on the phenotype of a transgenic plant. That's important, right? If you take a transgene, even if it's a great idea and it kills the transgenic plant, it's not going to be of any good whatsoever downstream by the commercial products. A very important consideration is they look for evidence of both toxicity to the plant, any kind of toxicity, plant, to animals that are in the area, to the environment, to people, and also allergenicity. I wish I had time to tell this great story about, I'm not sure who that was, Pioneer, who developed this great product line using a protein from Brazil nut and got it almost ready for commerciality and found out that it was highly allergenic in the human population. Weediness. What kind of effect does this have on the persistence in the agricultural habitat? So if we put a transgene in a new plant, will it persist in that agricultural habitat? How much does it invade the natural habitat? And scientists are taking very serious looks at some of these questions, partly because these are some of the questions that have been raised and have been argued about so much in Europe. What is the impact of these transgenes on non-targeted organisms? What are we doing inadvertently? Unintentional, unintended effects. What is the likelihood and the consequences, so if it does happen, that the transgene would move to other organisms or of movement? To other plants. That's primarily by cross-pollination. And then, I realize this is going to go, the last one that would be just probably below the line there of the board are some less defined, maybe, ethical considerations about the acceptability, for example, of putting antibiotic resistance markers in food products. Now, there's an article, they comment, that came out in a journal called Trends in Plant Science. That addresses some of these concerns very directly for GM crops, GM being genetically modified plants. This is in December of 99, so what, just over a month ago. Volume 4, number 12, page 467 to 69 or so. It's just a couple of pages. It's just an interesting article for those of you who are a little bit interested in this. You don't really care about the plant part, but are a little bit interested about some of this controversy surrounding the genetically modified crops. What is the public's perception? What is the scientific response to it? And I go into it, but it's not that interesting to me, which is unfortunate, because as a scientist, I can refute most of the complaints and the comments. But that's sort of not my purpose in this part of the lecture. If you're interested in that, that is here. So, for instance, what are they doing about antibiotic resistance in plants? And is that really a problem? If you eat a plant that has an antibiotic resistance marker, are you going to become resistant to that antibiotic? Or is your intestinal flora? The simple answer is no, you're not. And no, your intestinal flora is not either. And it explains all about it in here. It does tend to be, it's rude to say hysteria, and it's also rude to say ignorance, but it's a little bit of both. And this is actually just a nice, very general comment and commentary showing some of the studies that are being done. What it also does is it's very honest about saying, you know, scientists didn't really think about invasiveness in natural habitats. What are these transgenes doing? We didn't really think when they first started developing these. Are we going to be impacting non-targeted organisms? And so it does a nice job of saying now what they're looking at and what they're finding in some of these studies. So if you happen to be interested in some of this stuff, that's more there. But I didn't do much with it. So a little bit more on the extent of biotechnology. Turns out that actually China is the country that has the largest areas of transgenic crops. In fact, in this one article that I looked at, they predicted that by the year 2000, 70% of the total tobacco being cultivated in China would be transgenic. That tends to be mostly transgenic tobacco that's has a gene that confers resistance to cucumber mosaic virus. Now, most people don't care. I mean, most of you guys don't really care what we do to plants to engineer insect resistance or herbicide resistance. It only came when we started changing the food that people started to care what was happening in the plant world and the genetically modified crops. And so these things have come a long way before they got any public attention. But a very large percentage, this is 70% of tobacco. I told you 50% of the corn and the soybean in the world that's being grown is genetically modified, mostly for, against, in this case, this is a cucumber mosaic virus, tobacco mosaic virus. Most of these viruses are we've engineered resistance against some of these major problems. In fact, in tobacco, the transgenes have increased the yield of the tobacco 5 to 7%. So it's pretty hard to tell farmers, especially in some of these more developing countries, I'm sorry, we can give you a plant that now is resistant to its major pest, has a 5 to 7% higher yield, but you can't use it. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the plant itself. It allows them to decrease the amount of insecticide they put on their crop. That's a good thing, right? We're applying fewer chemicals then to the crops. Anyway, so this is, many of these plants are now completely commercialized at this point. Let's see. I think I've said all of that. The examples, I'm going to go through a whole bunch of examples. The next page in your handout is just a little bit more information. Millions of hectares. This gives you all the information for all the countries besides China. I don't even have China on here. Let's see, if we put China in here on the same table, in the year 2000, so these are basically from 1998, so a couple years old now, but the prediction was that for China in the year 2000, that about 14 million hectares in China alone would be transgenic, and this is for 14 million hectares, so it continues down from here, of transgenic tobacco only. So the point I'm just trying to make here is that here we're saying 28 million hectares in the world total will be transgenic, and yet just in China, or at least in this group, in China alone, 14 million of them of tobacco that's being cultivated was transgenic at that point. What's maybe more interesting is just some of these examples of the plant characteristics that have been modified. The vast majority of what's been done has been done with the insect resistance, viral resistance, and herbicide tolerance. So, and most people that are not plant biotechnologists couldn't care less about most of this work. And so it really hasn't received much attention. Some of these down here, I'll talk about these because they're of more interest to maybe a general population. And they're some of the more interesting strategies. Yeah.
Are there any examples of pests who have developed
Yeah, sure. That's one of the big problems or one of the big concerns, and that's one of the biggest concerns is the BT toxin. And by using this as a way to prevent infection by this particular insect, one concern was that the insects would become resistant to the toxin that was being used to kill them off. And this article, actually, I thought this was quite an interesting article, and it is a problem. So that has been a concern. If we start trying to change these insects, would we just get insects that are resistant, and then you've got the same problem all over again? And one thing that it talks about is that some of that's a dose response. And one of the problems that they have is that currently the transgene is usually expressed at fairly low levels in the plant, and so it may not be a high. So when you have, it's just like with antibiotics, you're more likely to develop resistance if you're being exposed to a toxin or an antibiotic at a low level. One way, what they're finding now is that if they express these transgenes in a chloroplast, they can produce tremendously high levels of the toxin that will actually knock off the insects before they're able to develop resistance. So the short answer is yes, they are having to be concerned about insect-developed resistance. The other part is that they're also now trying to deal with ways of getting around it. And because in a chloroplast you can make many copies of the same gene, more than on the nuclear level, they're using this as one way to get around it. They're actually expressing these genes in the plastids, in the chloroplasts, especially of these plants, as a way to get around a lot of problems that are had listed over here. But you have to read the article for all those details. Okay, so three things that you sort of have to think about are the ones we're going to talk about in case people really care. We're going to talk a little bit about delayed ripening. We're going to talk a little bit about the phytase content, or
We're going to talk some about starch metabolism. We're not going to talk any about that. Glyphosate, if anybody cares, that's Roundup. Roundup is a pretty common herbicide that was developed by Monsanto. I think those are kind of the main ones that we'll talk about. But when one's looking at a gene, say, for delayed ripening, that's one of the examples we're going to look at in a little bit. Make sure that this introduced enzyme, whatever the introduced enzyme, has affinities for its substrate so that it can compete with an endogenous enzyme. If the plant already makes one enzyme, why do we need to put in a transgene? So we have to make sure that the introduced enzyme will bind to whatever its substrate is in the transgenic plant. It's important that we look at the amount of the protein that's being produced, the product that's being produced in the plant. That's a little bit what he was asking, my answer to what he was asking is if we're producing enough of the toxin, for instance, to actually kill off the insects that are eating on the plant. And also the localization, the compartmentalization. It's important that the product is produced in the appropriate compartment within the cell so that it's completely functional. Most of the examples that I'll talk about and most of the examples you would think of do happen to be cytosolic proteins. In the case of Roundup in glyphosate, in fact, the enzyme that they're making, they had to make sure they targeted that to the chloroplast because that was where it's most active. And so it had to make sure that the compartmentalization, the final localization, was correct. Also within the tissue, you have to make sure that it's expressed in the appropriate tissue. It doesn't do any good to have an insect toxin being expressed in the root if the insects are chewing up the leaves. So tissue expression has to be appropriate, and so you want to think about that when you're designing your product. Okay, so some of the examples, let's see, one more page here, a couple more pages in your handout, just look at giving you just a little bit more information. This one talks about some very specific examples, who's actually developing them, and what state they were at. Now, this is an older article, so all of these that are actually pending have all been authorized at this point or else completely dropped from the program. This one, the tomato delayed fruit ripening. We'll be talking about this in a minute. This is the Flavor Saver tomato. DNAP's group, this is the Endless Summer tomato. All of these companies still exist in one form or another. They may or may not be called exactly this, but they're all still doing various forms of plant biotechnology. This was just the last then of the examples, or sort of odd examples. Amylose-free, we're going to talk about each of these very briefly. Amylose-free starch, cyclodextrans, and triolose. These are several compounds that have been expressed in plants. So in this, what we're listing here is how plants have been exploited as bioreactors. Some of you think of growing up microorganisms and getting them to produce large amounts of things. Plants have been exploited to produce large amounts of triolose, cyclodextrans. Talk about that in a second, and why we might want to even do that, or why that might want to be done. Thursday, I'll talk a little bit about using plants to express something like hirudin, which is a blood anticoagulant, and so being able to make very large amounts of this pharmaceutical, using plants to express large amounts of antigens to be able to work as natural vaccines. Phytase, we're going to talk about that a little bit today. This is currently this is an additive in animal feed. And so it's yet another chemical that's bought and fed to certain livestock, in this case boiler chickens. But if it can be actually engineered into the feed, then it can provide the nutrition that they need without having to do more additives. We'll talk about that a little bit too. I think those are the main ones that we'll talk about. So, okay. Mm-hmm.
figure one, this is just my prop so that I can talk about a few of these different examples, because most of you, and certainly I hadn't heard of many of these things before I started preparing these kinds of lectures. Amylose-free starch. So that's this guy over here. Amylose-free starch is something that they're trying to, that has been developed and expressed in plants, and they do it by antisense expression. We're going to talk about antisense expression a little bit. By antisense expressing some of the genes involved in the synthesis of this guy. This is important because microwave-ready foods need a lot of amylose-free starch. I know that this is going to thrill Aaron to no end. Because it, when you microwave foods that have this stuff in, it makes a clear paste, and it doesn't deteriorate when you microwave it. And so now when we're developing all of these foods that are microwavable, they want more of this kind of starch in your food because it doesn't like coagulate into a cloudy mess when you microwave it. So you want to look for this in your food, I guess. Cyclodextrins are another very common product that they are engineering now, using plants as bioreactors, metabolically engineering various, these are just a whole bunch of examples of carbohydrate metabolism. Ways they're altering carbohydrate metabolism in plants. Make more cyclodextrins. Most of you probably don't remember, and I don't blame you, but I actually talked about cyclodextrins on last Thursday. Those were one of the soil additives that I talked about that you could put in the soil, and it would free up some of the metals for being taken up into the plant. This is not actually why the main reason it's used. It turns out these cyclodextrin are really like cylindrical molecules, cylindrical structures. They're carbohydrates. And they carry what they call guest molecules. So they're used in pharmaceutical delivery, drug delivery, because these are carbohydrates. They're very hydrophobic. They're used for flavor and odor enhancement so that your food smells better and tastes better. They're used to remove undesirable compounds like caffeine. So this is one of these products because it's this cylindrical structure and it can carry guest molecules away. These guest molecules include undesirable molecules like caffeine that some people think they don't want in their food. Trehalose, this guy over here, this one is, I guess, important. It's currently made from yeast. So a lot of these were products that were not just sort of found in plants and we decided this was a good idea. These often come from other sources. Trehalose is made in yeast. You can get yeast to overproduce it. It costs $200 a kilogram to make trehalose. Plants would make this much less expensively, and the reason that we would want to make trehalose is that this is an additive that's added to foods, food additive. And it improves, this is going to be good for Aaron too, processed food and dried food. And it makes it fresher, makes it smell fresher. And they taste fresher. I don't know how you can add a chemical that, this is the chemical that gives freshness taste to your food. But anyway, that's what it does. And so it would be much less expensive to be able to produce it in plants than to have to isolate it out of the yeast that it's currently being used in. Phytase is down here. This is just some results. Currently, phytase is a feed phosphate. So this is a source of phosphate that's fed to little broiler chickens, or big broiler chickens, whatever. So if you feed, if you use this as an additive, the reason to use it as an additive with the broiler chickens is to get them to grow bigger. You want bigger broiler chickens because that's what people buy. But you have to buy it as a chemical. An alternative is to take this fungus and actually isolate the protein out of it. You can make it grow as much, but it's much more difficult. And so what some group is doing is actually using, has engineered tobacco seeds that will express phytase. So it expresses the gene for phytase. This is a fungal gene. It expresses the gene actually in the tobacco seeds. The tobacco seeds can be added to the chicken feed. The chickens eat these seeds. You don't have to add any chemical. You don't have to isolate it from the fungus. And you can get the same level of growth from the broiler chickens that you can get by doing all the extra work. This is also good because if you can feed it to them in their seeds, it decreases the amount that they excrete in their manure. And if you grew broiler chickens, apparently that's an important consideration.
I knew you were worried about that. Let's see.
Packaging them is in these kinds of seeds is very safe and stable, and nobody gets hurt. It's very good. Don't have to purify it. Don't have to do all these big isolation things to get it out of the fungus. You basically just let the plant produce the enzyme. It's a very good thing for broiler chickens. Okay. Now, I have just a couple of other short examples that I want to give you, and we'll talk about the transgenic plants. Sweet potatoes. This guy at Tuskegee University has engineered sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are an important crop in certain parts of the country, and what he's done with the sweet potatoes is increased protein content. Essential amino acids, most of you have heard of essential amino acids, and you know that they're essential because that's what they're called. They're called essential because we can't make them. We have to eat the amino acids. So what this guy has done is improved the nutritional value of sweet potatoes. I wrote sweat potatoes. Sweet potatoes by increasing the amount of the essential amino acids that these sweet potatoes produce. And he's improved and increased the protein content in these guys about 2.5 to 5-fold increase. There's a very slight increase in the overall yield of the sweet potatoes. So somehow increasing the proteins made them very good. Now he has just tested them on hamsters, and he found that hamsters fed on these sweet potatoes for 28 days weigh 56% more than hamsters that were not fed these transgenic sweet potatoes, that were fed control sweet potatoes for 28 days. So this guy has begun at least the process of testing his product on a non-human subject at this point. The other example that I think is somewhat interesting, because I had never considered it, is astaxanthin. Astaxanthin, I have no idea if that's the appropriate pronunciation, is a pigment. It's a carotenoid pigment. It's a natural pigment. It's found in tobacco. It's been engineered. Its production has been engineered in tobacco. This little guy costs, it's a pigment, $2,600 a kilogram currently on the open market. What one would want this for is to tint your flowers. It's a nice little reddish-orange color. Also, farm-raised shrimp. You know all those shrimps you buy in the grocery store? Farm-raised salmon. Nobody wants to buy them if they're pale, right? So they add astaxanthin to these guys, so they make them nice and orange. And in fact, I've never seen this, but when I taught this last year, somebody had seen it and nodded, that you can actually feed this stuff to chickens. If you feed this stuff to chickens, it makes the yolk a brilliant orange. Why you want this vibrant orange in your egg yolk, I don't know, but somebody wants that. So astaxanthin is currently extracted at this price. They get it from seashells, or they synthesize it chemically. So organic chemists or whatever have figured out a way to do this. Basically, the way this guy who's engineered this in plants, what he does is he has found, so beta-carotene, I'll do it up here. Beta-carotene is a natural pigment in plants. And what he did was he found an enzyme from green alga, it just happens to be called ketolase, which is about as useless general a term for an enzyme as you can imagine. And this particular enzyme is what was engineered into these tobacco. It makes a product called canthaxanthin. Canthaxanthin, can serve as a substrate for a number of plant enzymes, natural plant enzymes then, that can convert camphaxanthin into astaxanthin and make it a lot easier to extract it. This stuff actually will accumulate then in the nectaries in the flower. So you can go by and just collect all these little flowers and get this astaxanthin out of there and feed it to the chickens, and there you have vibrant orange egg yolks. So I'm not sure that this is what I would spend the rest of my life working on, but it is something that somebody has done to do with plant biotechnology. Now, why would you choose this besides money? Microbial systems. One could use, could engineer perhaps a microbial system to produce astaxanthin or to produce trehalose or something like that. One of the problems with microbial systems tend to be from prokaryotic systems. They don't do post-translational modifications that are often necessary. And so that limited capacity for some of those modifications make them of limited use in many cases. Often bacterial fermentation, large scale, can be very expensive. Often very expensive to isolate the aggregates. Many of you have tried to overexpress proteins in bacteria and know that all you get are big fat aggregates, and those aggregates aren't terribly useful. They can spend a lot of money trying to solubilize those aggregates. Transgenic animals are another possibility if you wanted to get astaxanthin produced in specific transgenic animals. There tends to be more public concerns when we start dealing with transgenic animals, more ethical concerns. So many people are avoiding, I suppose there'd be a lot of ethical concerns if you wanted to use animals simply to produce astaxanthin to feed to your chickens. Plants tend to have lower upstream costs. It doesn't cost all that much, actually, to hire a bunch of plant biotechnologists to figure out how to do something like this. The costs downstream tend to be a little bit higher. So that's the actual growing of the crop and doing the production of the grain or the fruit, whatever the lower, the downstream products are. Of course, it's important to design your plant system correctly. And that's something that we're going to talk about now for the rest of today and then on to Thursday. It's important that you have appropriate high-level expression. If you want to make a product, use a plant as a bioreactor, you want to make sure it's expressed at high levels, you're going to have to make sure that you use the appropriate promoters, appropriate leader sequences for the expression of the gene. You have to optimize codon usage. Plants tend to have a slightly different codon usage than animals and microbes. Have to make sure that the messenger RNA destabilizing sequences have been removed, because in many cases a messenger RNA that's stable in one system may not be stable in another system. Sometimes it's important to use other systems besides tobacco, although tobacco worked here. Tobacco was not useful for this guy down in Tuskegee because most people don't run around eating raw tobacco. And he wanted to use a crop that could be used in developing countries. It's where he was improving the protein content. Tobacco's not a good choice for this guy that's developing edible vaccines for the exact same reason. But tobacco's a very good place to do, use as a bioreactor to be able to produce a large amount of a material that you want to isolate. So your choice of species is going to be important. That important to make sure it goes to the right compartment, because if it's only has to function in the chloroplast, you have to make sure it's got the targeting signal for that. And of course, it has to be able to fold or into the appropriate structure. The final post-translational modifications all have to occur. That was why we didn't want to use microbial systems. So we need to make sure that it will occur in the plant system. That's probably enough on that. So that's sort of a big general introduction to and a lot of sort of small examples of ways in which plant biotechnology has been used. May or may not be some of the more important ways, but at least they do illustrate some of the variety of plant biotechnology at this point. I want to move on then to how one actually does gene transfer and regenerate plants. What would you do, or how would you do this? Assuming that you've now decided on what product it is you want to overproduce in plants or what trait you're trying to capitalize on. basically, one starts with a clone gene of interest. This is assuming that you've done a lot of biology already and you know exactly what gene you want to work for. You work with some gene of interest that's going to do your trait that you're interested in. It's important then to have stable introduction of that gene into some part of the plant. So stable introduction of the foreign DNA. This can be accomplished by several different transformation techniques. Transformation is the term for how you get a gene into an organism. The two that I want to talk about are agrobacterium-mediated transformations. And more of a vectorless gene transfer. Particle bombardment is an example that we'll talk about in a minute, electroporation. Assuming you've gotten stable integration and it has to be stable, that means that it doesn't go away if you go home for the night. It stays introduced into this organism, into the plant. Then you need to be able to regenerate the whole plant intact. This is not trivial. This is depending on the species that you're dealing with. This has taken many scientists many, many years. One can now regenerate intact plants from many species, but not all of them. And then, assuming one can regenerate a transgenic plant, it's important that your gene that you're interested in is expressed. So the expression of the introduced gene. Now these are the things that one has to figure out. Okay, what am I going to, how am I going to determine if the gene is expressed? What am I going to assay? What is likely to go wrong? Can we generate the plant? Have I chosen an appropriate species? At this point, obviously, tobacco, soybean, corn, rice. Most of the standard ones can be relatively easily transformed. Maybe not as easily as you might expect, but it's not too bad. So essentially, one has to design an appropriate transgenic construct. We've got a clone gene. Depending on how we're going to put it into the plant, we design a construct. Most of you are familiar with this, and I'm actually not going to give any specific examples. In a plasmid-based transgenic strategy, you have some kind of a promoter. That promoter is sort of the on-off switch for the expression of your gene of interest. This is your gene of interest. Astaxanthin production, perhaps, the triolose production, the enzyme that's responsible for that, maybe you're trying to produce that. The promoter, the choice of promoter can be very important. It can be of plant origin. It might be of viral origin. It might be of bacterial origin. You might have to look up some of these papers that I've listed when you're doing your homework to figure out what kind of a promoter you want. You have to make sure that you know whether you want it to provide constitutive expression. Do you want this gene on at all times? Do you want that plant making your toxin or making the gene to make triolose at all times? If you have a relatively innocuous gene product, it may be fine. Or do you want it to have an induced expression? If you want constitutive expression, put it under the control of a promoter that's on all the time, that's completely on. Do you want it expressed in all tissues? If you have something like you're increasing protein content, well, you probably want that in all tissues, or you certainly want it in the tissues where you're going to be eating it. But you may not want it in all tissues. A toxin you may not want in all tissues. Do you want environmentally inducible expression? A heat shock promoter, for instance, that will only come on under certain conditions. Monocots are another problem. I won't talk about that. Specific monocot promoters for things in monocots. You also need to have, and this is where the antibiotic resistant often comes in, some kind of a genetic marker.
What's going to be your marker? How are you going to know if your transformation has been successful? How will you know if this plasmid has been transferred into this new plant? You need some kind of a genetic marker. Antibiotic resistance is the one that's most common and has gotten the most public information. Herbicide resistance is another possibility. You might be able to use a marker for herbicide resistance, grow up all of your transgenic plants on a plate, apply that herbicide. Only those that have been transformed are going to live, and everybody else is going to die. And then you can take those transgenic plants and go from there. You have to be able to have some way to identify your transgene, is what the point is there. Okay. So, what I've assumed here is that you're going to introduce your DNA into the plant using a plasmid. A plasmid just refers to this circular piece of DNA. You can also introduce the DNA into plants as naked DNA. So this is a plasmid. There's your gene of interest. You're being very specific about how it's going to be expressed, where it's going to be expressed. But you might want to simply use the naked DNA for your gene of interest and put that into plants. Now, the first page on the handout from today, should show you this figure, which I don't find terribly useful, but some people might. These are different choices one has to make when designing transgenic plants. What exactly are you going to do? What are you going to transform? The most traditional way, and the way that when I've made my transgenic plants in the past, is basically this pathway. That's the most usual or traditional way. You take a tissue explant. That means to take some part of the plant and cut it out. You can make callus. Callus is sort of like cauliflower. It's what it looks like. It's non-green. It's completely undifferentiated. And under certain hormonal conditions, you can get this callus. You can find callus, I think, on here, other places. And then here's where you're adding the DNA. So these blobs are where you're actually adding your transgene. Make up a whole new plant. We've used root pieces, cut up little roots, transform those. Most people now use vacuum infiltration and actually take the a very young plant and vacuum infiltrate, so cause vacuum to get the DNA sucked up through the fruits there. Hormones are involved in most of these steps. Not a lot to say here. The open circles are agro-mediated transformations. The closed circles, so this is using agro. Agro is a bacterium that we'll talk about in a second. This is using particle gun bombardment. This is where you use naked DNA. Bombardment. This all happens because plants have this relatively cool principle or characteristic that they're totipotent. What that means is that any single cell of a plant at any time during its development can be de-differentiated, and then under certain hormones will re-differentiate into a full plant, unlike you and I, because at full development it's very difficult to take a single adult cell, de-differentiate that into an undifferentiated cell and regenerate a whole organism. Plants, however, that can be done, and that's the basis for all of these regeneration and regenerative processes. We basically take some kind of a plant tissue. Under hormonal conditions, you can make a callus and then regenerate a plant from that. Good enough.
The hard thing about doing these transformations, either using bacteria or using a particle gun, is you've got this piece of DNA, you got to get it through the cell wall into the plant as a whole. So if we've got a cell, a plant cell has a relatively hard cell wall, and you're trying to get that piece of DNA somehow through the cell wall, not only across the cell wall and the cell membrane, but actually into the nucleus of the cell, where it then will be expressed. And so that can be pretty difficult. One way to do it is through this particle gun bombardment. Another way, and I'll talk about that in just a second, another way is using high voltage electroporation and making the cells open up long enough to get the DNA in. Particle gun bombardment is a lot like what it sounds. You take a little bit of naked DNA and you precipitate it onto like gold particles or tungsten particles, and you literally shoot it into the plant cell. It's like a gun. It's not exactly a gun, but it's like a gun. And they used to use gunpowder to shoot the DNA into the cells. Now they tend to use more like a helium tank to shoot it in. The trick, and it is a bit of a trick, is to get just the right amount of tungsten or gunpowder that's got your DNA coated on it so that it gets into the cell and it doesn't just go right through the tissue. So it's important to, you have all these variables to test, but because this DNA, and this is the DNA out here coming into the cell, and you think of just shooting a gun at a cell, you know, what are the chances you're actually going to land in the cell without going all the way through? So there's a lot of work that's been done to try to do that. This actually, using helium works better than using gunpowder now. And most of the companies that sell these guns, these bombardment systems, use helium. This has been very helpful in developing monocot transformations, for example. Let's see. One advantage is you can shoot the DNA into almost any tissue. You really only need a little bit of tissue. So, like, if you imagine taking a petri dish, and that's what they do, you can take an embryo, for instance, and shoot the DNA into an embryo. I mean, DNA is not very big, right? You just have to get it into a single cell. Or you can take little pieces of leaves and shoot up a whole plate full of that, and then allow it to express and become a callus, and then grow up a whole plant from that. It's been really helpful, like, with growing up certain monocot tissues. Not so great for dicots for a number of other reasons. Dicot systems, we tend to be using the agrobacterium-based systems. I think the next page on your handout kind of just summarizes an example of using agrobacterium-based system. Basically, what this thing summarizes is just an old example. This is one way they were using EPSP synthase, is one of the genes involved in the glyphosate resistance, that's Roundup tolerance. And what they did was they took the gene out of a plant, put it onto a plasmid, so now they have the bacterial plasmid with the plant gene on it, put that bacterial plasmid with the plant gene on it back into the agrobacterium. Agrobacterium is a natural soil bacteria that causes crown gall tumors on plants. Normally, if you go out in nature, you'll find galls, tumors on plants, and it's caused by a bacterium. This is one of the bacteria that does it. So when we engineer this bacteria, now it can express the gene that we're interested in, put it back into a plant cell. The way that one gets agrobacterium into a plant cell, I'll show you in just a second, allow those cells to grow up, and then you can regenerate whole plants that are transgenic, that express the gene, in this case the EPSP gene. And in that case, those plants are now confer a glyphosate resistance or Roundup resistance that the non-transgenic plants would not be. And so they're able to withstand spraying with glyphosate. So in this case, they're able to select the cells that have taken up the plant gene because they can put the herbicide on these little plates and then grow up whole plants that are herbicide resistant. Okay. The details, although you certainly don't need to know them, but some people are somewhat interested in how one exactly gets the DNA from a bacterial cell into the plant cell. So I have a little picture of that here.
And it's really kind of cool. It happens from wounding, right? You got to imagine these roots are growing around in the soil, and they're going to get wounded at some point. When the plant gets wounded, it puts out some of these wound signals. And so it actually puts out an exudate. The exudate itself attracts the bacterium. So this is the bacterial cell here. And Agrobacterium does grow naturally in the soil. So here's your bacterium. Here's a root that's been wounded over here, putting out this signal. Maybe you want to put the whole root over there.
When it puts out this signal, this happens to be a sugar receptor that's on the surface of the bacterium, and it causes the expression of a whole system of genes, the vir genes, the virulence genes. You can kind of, it sounds sort of like an infection, just to have virulence. This is the DNA that's in the Agrobacterium. Anyway, so when this wounding happens, you're inducing the production of a whole bunch of genes. One of the sets of genes, or one of the plasmids that is expressed in these bacteria, is the TI plasmid. It's a tumor-inducing plasmid. That's why it's called TI. And so this is the actual plasmid where we would be putting our foreign DNA, where we would be putting our gene of interest, is on that TI plasmid. The TI plasmid expresses then what's called the T-DNA. The T-DNA is the DNA that's going to be transferred. Okay, so your gene that you're expressing, that foreign gene, is on the plasmid. When that plasmid is expressed, when those genes are expressed, it's part of the T-DNA. Some of the other genes that the Agrobacterium are expressing at that time will coat the T-DNA. So your T-DNA is now in here. It's being coated by these vir genes. These vir genes now come over here and interact with some more vir genes. And you can kind of imagine this whole snake now. Here's your T-DNA inside. It's got the foreign gene you're interested in. Is actually now being inserted into the plant cell. So the vir genes, there's a whole bunch of different ones, are the ones that are actually responsible for transferring the DNA into this other cell. Just because we've gotten into the other cell now, remember I said we had to get into the nucleus of the other cell, and that's where these vir E2 and vir D2, they're kind of cool because they actually have nuclear localization signals on these proteins. So these genes have made protein in the bacterium. They're coding the transfer DNA, the DNA that's being transferred into the plant cell. Your foreign DNA now is coded with some bacterial proteins that have nuclear localization signals, which allows it to go through the nuclear pore complex. That's what the NPC is. And you can integrate now the foreign gene, or the T-DNA, into the plant cell. What they're showing here is, under normal conditions, what's carried on that transfer DNA makes genes for these opines. These are actually nutrients for the Agrobacterium. I mean, why would, in nature, why would a plant do this? And it's because, why would the bacterium do this? They actually then get their own nutrition. The plant comes here, makes the nutrition to feed the bacterium. It's these plant hormones that are produced by the soil bacterium that results in tumor production. So this is where the tumor part would come from. This is nutrients for the bacterium. Now, in most of the vectors that you would use in the lab, you don't actually make these, either of these, because we're using fake bacteria. We're using engineered bacteria, so that instead of making the hormones to make tumors, which wouldn't be very good for us trying to make plants with tumors, and we don't really care if we feed the Agrobacterium, the genes that we're expressing, the gene that we're integrating into the plant cell, is our foreign gene of interest. So that's how one gets a gene expressed in another plant cell. All right, relatively quickly, I only have about 5 minutes, that'll be almost enough time.
I want to go over at least a little bit of this tomato fruit ripening stuff. So this was the first type of transgenic plant products that actually reached the market and became available commercially. I know that Flavor Saver is not being commercially marketed anymore. I don't know about Endless Summer. I honestly don't pay any attention to it. It wouldn't bother me at all to eat Endless Summer tomatoes. Fruit ripening has been a problem. Some of you I know are from California and are probably very well aware of problems with growing tomatoes. Let me just tell you a little bit about it. And this is the next page of your handout, so you don't have to write any of this down. And I don't have to write any down. I can read it to you. Basically, tomato fruit ripening involves all kinds of physiological changes, and people have been studying this for many, many years. What happens? How do tomatoes get ripe? Well, obviously, color changes. Think of a tomato. A non-ripe tomato is green. You know it's ripe when it's red. There's a lot of pigmentation changes that are going on. The texture changes. An unripe tomato is hard. A ripe tomato is soft. So there's a lot of cell wall and structural changes that are going on. And, of course, the flavor and the aroma of the tomato change when it goes from unripe to ripe. So they understand a lot about the physiology in all of this. They know that the hormone ethylene is what induces fruit ripening, and that as fruit ripens, it produces ethylene, and so it's kind of a cycle. So the ethylene produces ripening. As it ripens, then you need more ethylene. And so this is the cycle that the hormone is responsible for. Well, the problem is, if any of you ever have grown stuff in your garden, you know that ripened fruit gets soft, and it's really easily damaged when you harvest it, when you try to process it. And if you think about doing this at a commercial level, this can be a real problem. Those of us who wish we had fresh tomatoes out here in Michigan right now would like for them to be able to ship fresh tomatoes from California out here, and it's not easy at this point in this season. So one of the solutions was to harvest the fruit when they were immature, and then as they're being transported in the truck, to give them ethylene and allow ripening to occur then. Sounds okay. You can harvest a green fruit that's still pretty hard. It's going to be not so much damaged. Give it some ethylene. The problem is the fact that if we're harvesting these prematurely, they really don't taste so much like vine-ripened fruit. They're easier to harvest, but they don't taste like it. So that the solution, the biotech solution, was let's just inhibit the ripening-related genes. And like I said, they've been studying this for a number of years. The next page in your handout goes through what some of those ripening-related genes are. This shows the ethylene pathway of tomato fruit ripening. A lot of people spent a lot of years studying this. Starts out with methionine, which is just at the top off the page. You've got it on your handout. And you can see there's a number of enzymes that I've marked in green here. Polyglycuronase, ACC synthase, ACC deaminase, ACC oxidase. These are just all related to this particular component in the pathway. We know that downstream, as you make ethylene, you need all these enzymes to make ethylene. Ethylene is the hormone of fruit ripening, and that leads to flavor and aroma production that you get during ripening, cell wall softening that you get during ripening, and the appropriate pigment synthesis that you get during ripening. So what they exploited when they made these transgenic tomatoes was two things. The first thing they decided to do was to prevent production of polygalacturonase, PG. Because if they could do that, then they wouldn't get the softening of the walls. And the other thing then, that was what resulted in the Flavor Saver, the other thing they decided to do was to prevent ripening in the first place, and that was what happened with Endless Summer. So let me just talk about those a little bit more. Let's see. So one of the ways they did this was by what's called antisense RNA. What antisense RNA is that taking a single-stranded RNA for the gene, in this case making polygalacturonase, taking and turning it around, so antisense, making it in the other direction,
So I just took my gene for polygalactyronase, I turned it around, and I make antisense RNA. Most of you know that that RNA is normally single-stranded. If you take a sense RNA and an antisense RNA, they make a duplex. It's duplex RNA. And that's how they get, they use antisense technology, and they're actually doing this now in a lot of drug-based therapies, so many of you may have heard of this, to make duplex RNA. And duplex RNA, or this antisense RNA, that inhibits the production of a gene. They think that the main reason for this is that the RNA duplex is degraded. That double-stranded RNA in a cell is recognized as foreign RNA. There's other possibilities of what's happening. That maybe not getting RNA splicing, it may be that you're not getting good transport to the cytoplasm, and it may be that you're not getting translation. So the whole point and the reason I present this is just for some of you, if you've never heard of antisense RNA, you can get some idea of what it is. And it's basically taking the gene, turning it around, expressing it in the plant so that it binds up all of the single-stranded endogenous RNA and prevents expression or final product production. What they did then was to make the flavor saver was to use antisense of the polygalactyronase gene. That next page in your handout, almost the last page in your handout, shows a couple of things.
The very top is just about what I was just telling you, only a little bit differently. The Yang cycle refers to, the Yang is because of Shengfa Yang, who was this really amazing scientist who studied ethylene production for many, many years. He retired. He was at UC Davis. But here's ACC synthase. This is the this is one of the genes that they that they used antisense to prevent production of ethylene, ACC deaminase, ACC oxidase. Polygalactyronase was produced. This is down here. If we don't produce as much of that, then we wouldn't get the problems with the wall. And what the bottom here shows is you have to just look at basically this is activity versus RNA, that both, this is the test. If they add one antisense gene, they get neither activity or two antisense genes nor messenger RNA production for polygalactyronase. This is just the proof. Control a non-transgene, control non-transgene, and you can tell that if the antisense is being expressed, they weren't getting the production. It sounded like a really great idea that they could, you know, decrease production of this. And they found out that they could do this. You can see, or you can imagine, that if we just affect this, we're not going to change color. We're not going to affect any of these other genes, and so you would get a beautiful red tomato. It would have, it would be almost like it was ripe enough, but it would have not very much degradation because of the, there wouldn't be any polygalactyronase. And so that was a really good thing. The Calgene was a company in California. They marketed it as flavor saver. But they found out that by inhibiting the rotting, that it was able to ripen on the vine. And they found out that they had to take it, it didn't work. They had to take it out of the, off the market because conventional tomato picking machines damaged the fruits. And so it didn't work at all. It was a great idea, but it didn't work in the end. When they got it to commercial production, and the way they were picking tomatoes at the time didn't work, and so they had to go back. And that was when they went back and did the other kind. They got, they used antisense on ACC synthase. This is where they came up with what's called endless summer. So they transgenic, they used transgenic plants that expressed an antisense gene for ACC synthase, and then that would prevent production of ethylene, and they could use then ethylene to actually trigger. They could then later control when they wanted to trigger ethylene production and fruit ripening. And so that was, that actually worked for them. The last page of your handout is just a little piece from a brochure that DNAP put out. DNAP is the name of the company that developed endless summer tomatoes. and it tells a little bit about it, and then at the bottom it tells a little bit about DNAP's technology. This was a little three-fold brochure that they put out, and they actually had an order form. I didn't include the order form. It's very old now, and it was extremely expensive. This was when they first came out, actually a few years ago. And I don't, does anybody even know if we're still selling these things? I don't know. Do you know? No? I don't know. So that's just, that was the first set of transgenic plants that came to commercial production. So what I want to do then on Thursday is talk a little bit more about metabolic engineering and some biomedical products that were produced, the edible vaccines and this blood clot, this anti-blood clotter, Herudin, that's made on oil bodies, actually. They got soft, so that they got softer than they wanted them to, and so they weren't, they split, and they didn't expect that. I don't know why.
I guess, I don't know, it just seems to me that like picking them early wouldn't be that different than shutting off.
Well, the picking, you mean, oh, why don't they now, the problem with picking them early, that's what they do now. I mean, that's what you're getting in the stores now, and people think it tastes gross, so. So
can't they slow some of the ethylene then after that? And if that doesn't,
if you can stop ethylene production under, so that way you would have to make it so it's not a normal.
So you just want to stop the ethylene.
That's right, so that you can control it.
Okay.
So that's what the Endless Summer did, was stopped it so that they could control when they actually ripen it. Otherwise, they'd probably all ripen when they hit Wyoming or something before they got all the way out here. Well, they have, you know, the trucks. The trucks are specialized for ethylene production.
Oh, yeah.
And they have like little compartments that spray out a sort of like a little gassing truck or something.
I heard that they used that because hacking tomatoes for their flavor flavoring. Like, they made like crazy great tomato, but then they used.
But they used the wrong thing.
In the right,
starting
they used
material.
The,
well, that,
hacking tomatoes.
Yeah, so that, you know, maybe that was part of the problem then too.
Yeah.
So more than you ever want to know about plant biotechnology, right?
You know,